I'll go ahead and get started then. I'm going to introduce Michelle Poulos. Michelle Poulos' feature-length documentary film, A Late Style of Fire, Larry Levis, American Poet, had its world premiere at the 2016 Mill Valley Film Festival and was an official selection at seven more film festivals around the country. She is an award-winning poet and screenwriter. Her poetry collection, Black Laurel, was published by Iris Press in 2016, and her chapbook, A Disturbance in the Air, won the 2012 Slappering Hall Press Competition. Her poetry has been anthologized in Best New Poets in the Southern Poetry Anthology, as well as published in the Southern Review, Sycamore Review, Smartish Pace, and many other journals. Her screenplay, Mule Bone Blues, won the 2012 Virginia Screenwriting Contest, and afterwards was a second-round finalist in the 2015 and 2017 Sundance Screenwriters Lab Competition. Michelle Poulos.
Thank you, and thanks for having us, everyone, at Chop Suey. And it's an honor to be reading with Terry and Greg tonight. We were talking about music just a little while ago, and I think you might be reading your John Coltrane poem. We'll see. I'm not sure. But I think I will read a poem called Thread and Drone that I wrote after hearing about this Greek tradition. The tradition is basically, at a Greek funeral, songs are passed from one woman to the next. They're an improvised lamentation, and they're performed at the gravesite. A woman will start, and she will talk about some of the attributes of the deceased, or some of his interests, or his professions, and, you know, things like that. And then once she wears herself out, the next woman at the funeral at the gravesite will pick up the song, so there's this really interesting threading that sort of happens. So this poem is called Thread and Drone. At the dusk in the burn of rush lights on the hillside, a dirge howls in the woman's mouth, a keening song old as Andromache's lament. It begins with a drone tunneling the body with flame, bees stirring the chest. The fluid drift of its thread feathers the interior. The pitch breezes the dead through olive leaves, rises the way oblivious stars rise, an infinitesimal scuttle whose sweep is unchanging. Each sigh disturbs the air a little more, as if to say, what rapture, what sea returns its forever to our ears. Where a coin is held in the cold hand and a clutch of hair ripped from the skull and flung on the coffin, these twilight gestures give us grease. O cypress tree, O arch and pillar, when she fades, the next voice embroiders the song with guests and ceremonies. Even the tools of the dead one's profession will appear. If he was a mason, his trowel weeps tears of lime and ash. If a shepherd, the goats and ewes refuse the fields that hold them and march single file into the sea. When dirt is finally thrown over the coffin, a mourner's cry soars into a storm, groaning through walls until her hair uncoils and with her nails she slashes her cheeks. An infinite knot of black-clad women surrounds her, their clasped hands strung like pearls against the wind that hurries their feet. And I'm just going to read one more. And it takes place here in Richmond. New husband. He has done all he can. Emptied half the closet. Moved his razor to another shelf. He's hidden the photos of the first wife in the attic beside the fishing rod and the box of lures in their lichen of seawater patina. He's done everything he knows to do. Still, He'll hear the hours through the floorboards, the ache that will marry and marry him to my old city, the diner with its brick walls, dog statue in the cemetery, the man who once summoned me with his warm hand. At night, the woods twill, the clapboard siding. Such long winter months, all the owls starving. Thank you.
And now I'm going to introduce me, Gregory Donovan. He's the one that writes the poems, as Borges might say. And I teach at Virginia Commonwealth University, where I once had Terry Hummer as a colleague of mine. And Terry also helped us to start up Blackbird, which I continue to help edit along with Mary Flynn, who's here. And I teach there constantly, incessantly. I wanted to read to you a poem that's about John Coltrane, as Michelle mentioned. And the reason why I thought I would read it is to thank Terry Hummer for preventing me from making an ass of myself, because I originally said that the saxophone here in the poem had valves, and saxophones do not have valves. They have keys. And so luckily I'd shown him the poem, and he said, for heaven's sake, don't do that. All the saxophone players in the world will rise up against you, and you know, you'll be cast out. Yes, exactly. And this poem also celebrates the fact that John Coltrane, when he was in the midst of changing American music forever and one of the most skilled musicians ever to grace the planet, when he performed at, say, a gig in New York City, on his breaks, he would go to the break room and play scales and practice. So he was a perfectionist in the most admirable way. And I would like to say I aspire to be like him. This poem is called Breathing in the Cool. John Coltrane, there on the edge of a red morning, leans on the sill of an open window, breathing in the cool wind that pours over his shoulders. The air mixed with some rare complex smoke, a taste of plum and pepper, as the song makes itself ready in him. He fingers the instrument sleeping in his hands. The pads pop, the keys clack, until the song grows taut and restless, until it has to be let go. He will follow it on. The song turns down an alley, slips downstairs, lies on its back in the dark, and will not move. But it crawls out, gets back on its feet in the middle of the street. When it goes strutting downtown, looking for trouble, it is going wherever the hell it has to go, and it rolls on in the might and rumble of thunder. Deep into it, in the heart of its fog, there, where nothing can be held down or numbered or stolen, where nothing can be salvaged or hauled back, there, at that depth, where you can tap the perfected emptiness at the center of its making, he finds its spirit breath hovering right there beside him in the room. It is a lemon-colored light, and now it begins to dance and slowly to blossom. It is heavy water, the clear flower splashing back into itself after the stone. It is a tree, feeling out to find its every possible root and limb. It is death, someone else's death, at the moment you hear of it and know that same death will be your own. It is the mother of all knowing, everything you have known and forgotten, until the song plays it out again. It lives at the edge of invention, and it means to go on and on. He believes it would like to kill him, and what in the world does it want? It wants elegance. That is all, and is all that can save him. It is all that can take him up. As the song finishes, the light gathers itself. It flies into the bell of the horn and vanishes into the mouth and throat of John Coltrane, where it will live on, making it back through song after song, coming back to kill him one more time. And I will read one more poem, the new poem. So for some time, I've been embarrassed that I just didn't feel competent enough as a poet to write a poem for my wife. It just seemed like something that was an impossible task, because if I was to write a poem for my wife that she deserved, it would have to be something to cause all of you to bleed from your eyes, to cry out in pain, and to roll around on the floor and writhe a bit. And so I won't do that to you tonight, I promise. But eventually, of course, I just gave up on that idea and thought, damn it, I just have to write something, because she's always embarrassing me by reading these wonderful poems about me. This is called Wine and Rain. What could be wrong with a drive into mountains where days before, muddy floods washed cars from blacktop roads into boiling creeks where some drowned and others vanished? Or the way trees ripped up along raw banks hiss as we pass wordless. We've left sunlight behind us, heading up into bruised clouds massing over evergreen horizons, peaks cloaked in wisps of smoky lace. How it is now and will be. The planet's dying and angry and letting off some steam. Inside the mountaintop winery's hothouse, its damp tropical spell of green bananas hanging down over impossible lush greenery, a pair of rainforest tree frogs chirrs loudly as they can against the woman at the piano and her melancholic singing. We raise flutes of sparkling rosé to a driving rain, now pounding in thick rippling sheets over the glass roof and walls, the flash and explosion of lightning, the lights gone, the pine bursting into flame. Fragile as any filament, we offer our glassy smiles to each other, placed here and gladly faced here with all this rumble and stir, ready to head out and take our chances. Thank you. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Terry Hummer to you. His most recent books of poetry are the three linked volumes, Ephemeron, Scandalon, and the newly published Eon, all from LSU Press. And After the Afterlife, which came out from Acre Books just last year in 2017. Former editor-in-chief of the Georgia Review, New England Review, the Kenyon Review, and Cimarron Review, he has been the recipient of a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Arts grant, the Richard Wright Award for Artistic Excellence, the Haynes Poetry Prize, and the Donald Justice Award in Poetry, among many other honors. Born on a farm in rural Mississippi, Hummer is the author of 14 books of poetry and essays, and has published his poetry and essays widely, including in The New Yorker, Harper's, Atlantic Monthly, The Paris Review, and Blackbird, and elsewhere. He previously taught at Arizona State University, University of Georgia, VCU, Kenyon College, University of Oregon, Middlebury College, and Oklahoma State University, and he now lives in Cold Spring, New York. Please welcome Terry Hummer.
Oh, there's a lot of people back there. I couldn't tell from over there. Thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to be here in Richmond, where I spent some very good years and enjoyed very much being here, and have still many friends, including Greg and Michelle, of course, and Mary Flynn, who's here, I'm glad to see, and David Wojon, and many, many others. Richmond is one of the best places I ever lived. I loved it here and moved on, maybe not for the best reasons, who knows. I wanted to edit the Georgia Review, and so I went away because it wasn't here. But thank you. As Greg said, I have two new books, After the Afterlife and Eon, which I'm on sort of on the road in this kind of peripatetic reading tour that goes on forever and yet never seems to be very long, to flog, as we say in the trade, and yet the bookstore hasn't been able to get them, and so I'm only able to flog these books to a certain extent. I just make you aware of them. They're available elsewhere, like on Amazon.com, After the Afterlife and Eon. On the other hand, the fact that the books aren't here frees me of the responsibility of being responsible for them, and I can actually read some new poems in addition to some poems from these books. So I'll start with my version of a domestic poem, since we had a poem by husbands and wives for each other. I'll read a poem about my dog. And the poem is called Anger Management because the dog is a beagle. So if you've ever lived in a house with a beagle, you'll know what I mean. I don't even have to explain. Anger Management. I was angry when the dog pulled my copy of On the Genealogy of Morals off the table and chewed on it for half a day in the alcove before I found out. I managed to drag one sentence out of his slathering jaws. Of necessity, we remain strangers to ourselves, and found the utterance uncharacteristically damp for Nietzsche. The rest of the book was inside the dog, and you know what that means. He had swallowed, we are noble, good, beautiful, and happy. Had swallowed it whole, dumb mutt, and I knew I'd find it on the lawn in a day or two, alongside nothing is true, everything is permitted. He was digesting that one at this very moment, thereby undoing $400 worth of dog obedience class. I tell you, I was furious. It was my favorite book. I'd owned it for decades. Its marginalia traced the history of my conscience. But I coaxed him out of hiding. I gave him a cookie. I stroked his ears and went on reading Nietzsche in my head. Each one of us is farthest away from himself. I could not punish a dog for only doing the same thing I had done, but more quickly and more efficiently. And this satisfied Nietzsche, who scratched my belly, threw a ball across the room, and stood with his hand out, waiting. Beagles don't belong in the house. It's just not a thing. So I'll read one poem from the other book. And this book is very different from that one. Tonally, technically, in just about every possible way. This poem, I think, explains itself. It's called Greek Fire, though. I may say a word about that. Greek fire is a weapon, which nobody knows quite what it was, but it was a liquid that could be poured out of a big urn onto the sea and set alight. And if it was set alight, it would burn intensely for a very long time, and they used it, apparently, it is said, to burn the ships of their enemies on the sea. They used it in naval battles. It's a mystery. Nobody knows what it was or how it was made, although the Confederacy claimed to have reinvented it during the Civil War, and they were going to use it to burn Manhattan to the ground. None of that really has anything to do with the poem directly, except that Greek fire in my head is also the fire of Heraclitus, the philosopher who said that everything is made of fire. So this poem is called Greek Fire, and it's dedicated to the children of Sandy Hook and all the others. The earth is made of stars, the teacher said, and all the stars are burning. We are learning how the stars are made. A big bang, and it's day. The sad black holes bleeding dark all morning. The earth is made of stars, the teacher said, and we are made of earth. All the dead lie in the earth, and we will too, returning, learning how the stars are made to disappear. They are destroyed by light. They are brought to less than nothing. The earth is made of stars, the teacher said, and when they have bowed and entered, it is from their own light they are hiding. We are learning how the stars are made and unmade. We betray them, and we are betrayed by other big bangs, the fumbling of God. The earth is made of stars, the teacher said, unlearning how the stars are made. I think since I don't have to sell books, there are books for sale, but they're older books, and they're books of Greg's and Michelle's also, and I would be remiss not to mention that because we are in a bookstore. So that's a good thing. But I want to read some new poems from a manuscript in progress, which right now is called, and this may just be a working title, I'm not sure, it's called American Bardo. Bardo being, of course, the place where in the Buddhist metaphysics is where you go when you die, but it's a place that you just pass through. It's a kind of transitional place. but it's not easy to get out of necessarily. The enlightened pass through quickly, and the less enlightened pass through more slowly, and you know, things happen. But it feels to me like, I'm not a Buddhist myself. I'm a kind of Buddhist fellow traveler. My wife says that she's an Episcopal Buddhist, and this doesn't bother either the Episcopalians or the Buddhists. They're all happy to get along together. So I'm a fellow traveler, so to speak, and I observe things. But the idea of an American bardo seems to me to fit where we are now. Because I don't know how you feel about it. It seems to me that anybody, no matter what your particular political vision is, ought to be horrendously worried about what's going on right now. You know, I don't care how you view it. I don't care which side of the political spectrum you're on. Our situation is not a good situation. It's just not a good situation. And it feels to me like we're in a kind of bardo. We're wandering around in the dark, bumping into things, and discovering monsters where we didn't know they existed. And this manuscript is trying to address this, you know, via the means that poetry has, without being a polemic. So I'm going to read some of the poems, and just think of everything in all these poems as metaphors or allegories for our current political climate. Dark meter. A gray horse came to me out of the fog. Not my horse, but the fog was mine, and the horse was lost in it, or I was. But if I was not the rider, someone else had fallen, and if I had not fallen, why had the horse come to me and not to another? And why was the world so numinous and so impossible to see? Her coat was filthy with sulphurous ooze. She wanted me to groom her. I would make her beautiful as we had both imagined ourselves to be. I would become the unfallen one for her, traveling into the light, but I had not fallen. The horse, I tell you, was not my horse. It happened ages ago in another country to people with unpronounceable names and lives I can't remember, the dithyram of half-heard hoofbeats. I am too busy here in my fog, living forever. Market. In the parking lot of a strip mall, I saw the body politic shambling behind a grocery cart. Or was it walking a big borzoi? There was something vague about it, almost undefinable, and I knew exactly who it was, like a politician or a movie star wearing sunglasses. You know the face, but not the name. In this case, it was the opposite. The face was out of focus, but it was the body politic, all right. It was humming a diminished chord. It was singing something I could barely hear. I hurt, I hurt, I hurt. Fix it. The same thing it was saying when Oedipus met it in the marketplace. Oedipus was on his way to his desk at the palace. He had just bought a sticky baklava, and he had a briefcase full of scrolls that needed signing, but he paused beside a soldier while the body politic passed. He listened to it mumble for a moment, and then turned toward the soldier's gleaming shield to check his own reflection, and ran his honeyed hand through his royal hair. Spat. As though I had expectorated into the soup tureen in the middle of dinner, I found myself an object of contempt in my own home, a hissing and a byword whereat the mob gathered in the street outside my window, chanting in actual language, until even the dog packed up in solidarity and moved into a shelter. Was I in the wrong lane to navigate the closing of the gyres? I stood alone in the garden back of the house wearing a cast-off bathrobe, cursing God and dying as I'd been told I had to do. Even when the house collapsed, killing the children, I was resigned. It was something I said or didn't say. It was a suicide bomber in my jeans. There was a hole in the pocket of the bathrobe I thought I should vanish into, but the physics of the situation overwhelmed me. I wanted to build my life over from the neutrinos up, or maybe to discover what really happens inside a black hole. Old and solitary, neither nobody nor a nation, in spite of everything, I was still curious and curiouser. At gunpoint, I could keep an open mind. Moving along a bit, okay. Cabeza de Vaca is one of my favorite characters from history. He was a Spaniard who came with conquistadors and got lost, basically, to make a long story short, in Florida, and wanted to rejoin Cortez. And so Cortez was in Mexico by then, and somehow Cabeza de Vaca knew that. So he walked from Florida to Mexico. You know, that was not an easy journey. It's not an easy journey now, but it was certainly not an easy journey then. And along the way, he had to do all kinds of things to survive. So he pretended, among other things, to be a god to the native peoples who accepted him for a while. And then when they realized he was a charlatan, they chased him out again, and he had to run. And so his story is really quite incredible. So he makes a cameo in here. I just wanted to mention him, because otherwise you wouldn't know what the hell I was talking about. Think. It's impossible sometimes to make your way through the undergrowth. Think of DeSoto. Think of Cabeza de Vaca hacking down briars with a sword of flaming Toledo steel. A sword, mind you. In Toledo, they've made that metal since 500 BC, and de Vaca was a god, or so he said, to save his own hash. But even he was helpless before a wall of poison ivy, broken to sweat and spit by impervious Mandevilla. It's a new continent every time. You're a stranger. Nothing knows how shining and vital you are. And every time you get stuck in a bank of crappy fetter bush, you think of Homo erectus broaching the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, but fire comes out of the brambles. You want to speak like an angel of the clean cartography of your own mind, but what comes out of your mouth is a tangled mess of thorned cliches. Think of Neil Armstrong lasering mountain laurel in the Sea of Tranquility. Think of the first human in Paris hammering her way through impenetrable banks of tourists on the Champs-Élysées. Think of your body or the left eye of a white baneberry. Think of launching the lifeboats into the viney deep. Think of the children. Now, since I'm in Richmond, I would be very remiss not to read this poem, which is called A Monument. But in this case, you have to think of Abraham Lincoln and the Lincoln Monument in Washington. He's sitting in a chair. It's an enormous Lincoln. I sit on the front porch in the Adirondack chair, assuming the posture of Lincoln. A mockingbird passing by salutes me. I don't wave back. Even made of granite, I am petrified by fears for the soul of the nation. I would pace the boards, but I am 19 feet tall, sitting down. The overwhelming weight of me would destroy the front of the house. This is what it means to be mythological. If I were alive, I would whistle a hornpipe, try puckering granite lips. I would smoke a cigar. I would summon Walt Whitman from the ward of dismembered soldiers. We would play a game of whist. The country is rotting and all the grown-ups are dead. If I stood, I would reach 28 feet, not counting my stovepipe hat. The day of reckoning arrives, dressed in hazy sunrise, and I'm helpless, locked in my own sheer mass. Try striking a match with granite fingers. Try shuffling cards. I should proclaim emancipation. I should write an address, but my hands weigh 500 pounds each. It's a morning in August, and the mockingbird won't leave. Perched on a branch, it does what mockingbirds do, grooms its feathers in the sunlight, pecks a sultry beetle. It cares nothing for the rights of anyone. Its freedom is its end. Glory, hallelujah, it warbles. All my stone eyes have ever seen. Per capita. A foggy morning. Alarm of the moon ringing over the horse pen. Up the road, carpenters return to their ripsaws, and in the middle distance, a farmer takes a wrench to his bulky tractor. A crow considers the bottom line of a skunk's corpse. Chlorophyll wipes the green sweat from its vegetable brow. Everywhere you look, sentience is picking up its lunchbox, glaring at the factory clock, rolling its sleeves above the elbow, and punching in. Nobody thinks of the beetle doing his solitary work in the dark mineshaft of horse dung, crafting his perfect sphere, pushing it up the slope towards sunrise. How pointless is it all, really? And how lonely is this six-legged Sisyphus of shit? He seems not to mind if a rainstorm undoes his morning's labor. He returns to the stinking assembly line to begin again. The first section of the book, as it now exists, I've got about half of this manuscript now. So this is the first section is complete, and it's called Declarations. That's all of those are from that. The second part is called States, and I realized at some point that the thing to do here was to write a group of poems. I'm not done with this section yet, but every other one is the name of a state of the Union. And every other one is the name of a state that is a state of mind. So that seemed like a way to layer up the mind of the body politic and the condition of the country, so to speak. So the first one is called Sentience, which is obviously not a State of the Union, so you can figure out what which side this one goes on. Sentience. I feel ill every time I see his face on a flyer, a billboard, a screen. I feel the wolves of anxiety rip my liver. I feel worms quiver asleep in the decadent boles of sycamores. They are certainly real sycamores, aren't they? Every time he speaks, I feel the rot blaze up, driven by ugliness and doubt. It would be better to be nerveless like a fungus or a stone or a fake sycamore. But how do I know they're not repulsed as I am, but more slowly and more quietly? Sentience is the curse of being when being is busy being cursed. Even the cockroach is in bad faith about being a cockroach. Even the brick in the asylum wall is jaundiced by his shadow. Even the dead recoil from him, nauseous, gnashing, still rocked by agita in bardo, watching the evening news. I'm skipping Kansas. I don't feel like going to Kansas. I'm skipping New Jersey. I was just there. Did I skip Alabama? No, let's do Alabama. Alabama. More statement than state, like a message in unbreakable code held up to a looking glass. I could say I remember cotton fields in winter, the dead stalks held up to the overcast sky like titanium candles in a satanic ritual, the hooded ones chanting from the Book of Infernal Names, Aziel, Amon, Alabama. But I remember nothing. Memory here is toxic, a sleeping draft for the torture. How does it feel, this February frostlight, to be the mirror image of Mississippi? Sleep on and suffer. The dream of another life can never grace you. Sweet home is gone forever, stripped like a double wide from the trailer park in the face of a blind whirlwind. Borderline. This one is somehow about immigration, but, you know, think about it. Everyone wants to kill the soul, especially the body, which lies in wait with a blackjack around the corner of the third cervical vertebra to bash that ghostly skull in. Things look grim, but the soul, no fool, lights out in a red Dodge muscle car, sprawled out between the seats, high on ectoplasm and OxyContin. Nobody knows who's driving, but they're bearing down on the boundary fast. One metaphysic for the unborn, one metaphysic for the dead. What business does a soul have anyway, here in the heart of the heart? We're all going down that highway, hell bent for another world, fishtailing and swerving our way dead onto the impervious checkpoint. South Dakota. I am done with the poetry of memory. A thing I'm not supposed to say, but if I stick with memory, all I have is a couple of mental Polaroids of the Corn Palace in Mitchell in 1955, and since they change all the corn every year, where is that Corn Palace now? Maybe I remember a saltbox farmhouse, a vanishingly narrow staircase, a strange trap door. Maybe there was a pile of old coal where bad children made war. Maybe I was a bad child. The gods are convinced that memory is the sine qua non of poetry, but who can remember a single poem anymore? I was 5 that summer. There was a golden cloud of bees in the copse down the hill sometimes. That was how you knew the god was present. That and the bad children disappearing. You will not speak my memories, the god said. I remember with absolute clarity when I stopped remembering. So, I'll just read one more poem, and then we could talk, or we could go home, depending on how you feel about it. This poem got written because in the last month, 5 poets of my acquaintance have died. 5. That's a lot, right? So Tony Hoagland was the first of them to go, and then Pete Everwine, who was 88. So with Pete, it was not so unexpected, but still a huge loss. He's such a wonderful poet. And then my friend Arthur Smith, and then someone you don't know, if you know those poets, you don't know Mark Bilbrey, who was a graduate student of mine at the University of Georgia when I taught there, 39 years old, died senselessly in a one-car accident, nobody knows why. And then, just a few days ago, the poet Leon Stokesbury, who was an old friend of mine. And these losses are close to the bone, you know, they're close. There are people my age. There are people younger than me. The only one older than me was Pete. Of course, I'm older than even that cat. So these things, hello, cat. These things weigh increasingly as one ages and one's friends and one's colleagues and people one admires disappear. And even the cats have no respect. And so it goes. So I've been on this trip, you know, going here and going there and reading poems, and I realized actually what I'm doing is going to see old friends. That's really what I'm doing. You know, the readings are fun and it's nice to meet new people, but I need to see my people because, you know, who knows? People are disappearing left and right. 3 weeks and five are gone. Is that going to continue? Do I need to call the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta and find out if there's something happening to the poets? I don't know what's happening. So, it's called California, and it's In Memoriam, Peter Everwine, 1930 to 2018. Just before the season of fog in the Great Central Valley, I will put on my gray coat one last time and walk out toward Kings Canyon, heading east again, back into the sun I came from in the glory before I was a body. Can it be true that the tule fog rises from the peat of prehistoric swamps under the vineyards of Visalia? There's already too much vagueness on the horizon, too much I can't see through, but I know the trail leading up to the sequoias. Many have walked this way before me, leaving flip-flops, sunglasses, canteens, skulls, strands of DNA in their passing, toward the final restitution. They've returned to their golden state, as we all were once in the sunrise, making our joyous way toward clarity at last, hoofing it out ahead of the impervious fog bank of America. Thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And I also should say that I appreciate Greg and Michelle, they read shorter than they should have, but they were kindly making room for me since I'm the guest from out of town. So I appreciate that in them too. And I would say that there's probably a little bit of time left, and if anybody wants to do a Q&A at all, that would be fine. If you have questions or anything you'd like to discuss from what you've heard, or otherwise we can just adjourn. Yeah?
I have a question on the way you create your poetry.
Okay.
Do you always start with a vision that you want to describe, or how often do you come up with a phrase that you think is pretty good and you build a poem around that?
That's actually the more usual way, because I think that for me at least, the poems tend to arise out of the music of language and go, but all of one's instincts, you know, as a poet are to also go for images, which is maybe not the best instinct all the time. In fact, you know, it may be a habit or a tick of some kind. Because poetry has not always been built out of images as much as it is now. But for me, still, that's the way it tends to work. And usually it's a phrase, a line. And I read that one Villanelle because I do tend to write from time to time, though I write mostly free verse anymore. I do from time to time write poems that are traditionally formal poems. And I have often wondered myself exactly how I decide that. There is, in this book, one Villanelle. Each of the books of the trilogy has one villanelle. The first book got a villanelle just because I wrote one. The second book got one, too, because I started writing a poem and realized it could be a villanelle and made it into one. And then when I wrote the third book, I realized that it had to have one because the other two books each had one. But even though there's no real rationale for that, and it doesn't make any difference to the book thematically, it's about music, you know. And so I wanted that music present. And very often it's from the first line that I come up with that I make a decision on some level about whether it's going to be a free verse poem or not. If it seems to have the potential, as in a villanelle, to be repeated many times, or if it seems to have the potential to benefit from being accompanied by other lines that have a similar kind of end sound, then I'll go that direction. But I don't have any particular axe to grind about that. So, you know. But the starting point is always, I think, the sound of a phrase. What about you?
Me?
You. Yeah, you.
I think that the thing that usually gets me started is I begin thinking about a story. Mm-hmm. A story that I don't understand. And so I write about it to understand it mm-hmm. a bit more. Mm-hmm. Or else make it even more mysterious to myself mm-hmm. and my readers.
Yeah. I think it's the opposite of my method these days. I think I have a sound that I then want. I require it to become a story, which is a different approach. What about you? David Wojahn, he's a fabulous poet. How do you do this?
Oh, I don't know. I usually keep, I guess you'd call it a commonplace book, where mm-hmm. I jot down things that I read that seem worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. You know, that Mao eliminated 5 billion sparrows during his first 4 pests campaign. That seemed really worth writing down.
Yeah.
And I keep those journals, and usually if I have 4 or 5 of those things that I can juggle and put together, that starts the poem.
Okay.
So it's collage-like all the time.
Yeah, okay. Well, how about you, Michelle?
Yeah, kind of similar to David, I think, mm-hmm. really jotting down sort of ideas and playing with that. Yeah similar.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I never have notes ahead of time. That's something I just don't do, you know. But again, it varies enormously from poet to poet, and it also varies within, I think, the writing life of a particular poet. One's process has a tendency to evolve and change in ways that one cannot foresee, and you can't teach this stuff either. You know, you can talk about it to a class, but you can't really teach anybody how to do process, because everybody's got to do it a different way and figure out their own way. So it's kind of dicey, actually, in a way, as a teaching thing. But in terms of what one does what one does. It's always there's kind of a desperation in it on some level, to just to get it done and figure out how to do the next one.
Yeah. And we have to stop there because we have to let the people who run the store leave sometime.
No, I don't see why. Okay. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.